Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the Club. Tonight's program is being held in association with the Golden Gate Chapter of the Association of Fundraising Professionals and Northern California Grantmakers. You can find the Commonwealth Club online at commonwealthclub.org. And to further discuss Commonwealth Club programs, visit the club's blog at commonwealthclub.blogspot.com. Today, we salute National Philanthropy Day, observed every year in November. This day was established by the Association of Fundraising Professionals to celebrate people's astonishing impulse to give away money, time, and expertise. In 2008, when the Dow Jones lost 37%, corporate profits declined 18%, and unemployment rose to 7.2%, which of course sounds good now, the estimated change in giving dropped just 2%, or just 5.7% when adjusted for inflation. So let's begin tonight by showing our appreciation to all those who continue to give so generously in our community. The philanthropic process is both important and engaging. Beyond providing needed support for worthy organizations, philanthropy is one of the grounds on which a competition takes place between different claims about what's important in our society. Is education a priority, or social services for the neediest, or policy studies, or scientific research, or, with its more limited dollars, philanthropy can never equal how the business and government sectors shape our society. But philanthropic dollars often act as a trim tab, that is, the small, movable tab within a ship's rudder that, through small changes, can ultimately direct the course of the vessel. Philanthropy can put new issues on the map, like it's done recently with the nature of our agriculture and the food supply system. It can change priorities about funding breast cancer research or AIDS-HIV research. It can even help to get a conversation going and create a national priority, as has just happened, to pursue the elimination of nuclear weapons. This is a crucial time for philanthropy, when many challenges are arising. Philanthropy is more effective than ever. With standards to measure outcomes and creative new methods like online fundraising to encourage far wider participation. But with the national unemployment rate now at 10.2% and with governments at all levels cutting back social services, the demands on philanthropy are increasing. And if, because of the state of the U.S. economy, philanthropy now has to step up to replace declining ticket revenue for arts organizations, or to replace the advertising that has previously supported newspapers. In other words, to underwrite basic services that have been previously supported by business or consumers, how will philanthropy continue to have the funds to push the envelope towards new priorities for our society? Our program tonight is entitled Philanthropists Who Inspire, and we're looking forward to hearing some of the Bay Area's most thoughtful and effective philanthropists talk about their giving and discuss some of the most pressing questions facing philanthropy and the nonprofit sector. So first to my left, we welcome Diane Didi Wilsey, an ardent patron of the arts. She is serving her third term as president of the board of the Fine Arts Museums of San Francisco. She chaired the $200 million campaign to rebuild the DeYoung Museum. Ms. Wilsey and her late husband, Alfred Wilsey, were one of five major donors to the DeYoung, giving over $10 million. Dee Dee Wilsey received a Distinguished Achievement Award in 2005 with the museum director, Harry Parker, at National Philanthropy Day for their work on the Fine Arts Museum. And with Al Wilsey, she was named Outstanding Philanthropist in 1992. Ms. Wilsey also serves on the board of the San Francisco Opera. This year, as opening weekend grand sponsor, she supported the opening production, Il Trovatore, and sponsored Opera in the Park. She's also a vice chair of the San Francisco Ballet and a distinguished benefactor. To her left is Warren Hellman, chairman of Hellman and Friedman. He is the former chairman and trustee emeritus of the San Francisco Foundation and co-chair of the California Commission for Jobs and Economic Growth. At National Philanthropy Day in 2003, Warren Hellman and his wife, Chris, were named Outstanding Philanthropists. They are major supporters of the San Francisco Ballet, the opera, healthcare, and education at all levels. Mr. Hellman is perhaps most familiar to the general community as the founder and sponsor of the annual Hardly Strictly Bluegrass Festival. Now in its ninth year, it is estimated that over 700,000 people showed up in Golden Gate Park last month to enjoy 80 acts on 6 stages over a 3-day weekend, all for free. Mr. Hellman played his 5-string banjo with his group, the Wronglers, and sang the saga of Isaias Hellman, his great-grandfather, who was one of the great financiers of early California, becoming the president and controlling shareholder of Wells Fargo Bank. Mr. Hellman's current civic activities also include member of the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors, member of the advisory board of the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley, member of the board of directors of the San Francisco Chamber of Commerce and the Bay Area Council. In September, Mr. Hellman announced a $5 million grant to start the Bay Area News Project. This is to be a nonprofit, nonpartisan, publicly supported news organization. In collaboration with KQED and the University of California Berkeley Journalism School, its mission is to create an open dialogue about civic and community news. To Mr. Hellman's left, we welcome Akiko Yamazaki, who, along with her husband Jerry Yang, the co-founder of Yahoo, is an active supporter of many Bay Area organizations. Much of their support has been aimed towards their alma mater, Stanford University. Over the years, Ms. Yamazaki and Mr. Yang have funded scholarships, undergraduate education, and other campus programs at the School of Engineering, the Asia-Pacific Research Center, the Stanford Japan Center, and the Jasper Ridge Biological Preserve. In 2007, Ms. Yamazaki and her husband personally pledged $75 million to enhance multidisciplinary programs at Stanford. The bulk of the gift was focused on construction costs for the new Environment and Energy Building, which is setting a standard for green building and interdisciplinary research. Ms. Yamazaki and her husband also co-chaired the $1 billion campaign for undergraduate education at Stanford University. She serves on the executive committee of the Asian Art Museum in San Francisco and until recently on the San Francisco Ballet Board for over 10 years. Together with her friend Charlie Knowles, she co-founded the Wildlife Conservation Network in 2002, which selectively supports entrepreneurial conservationists working in close partnerships with the local community. And finally, Laura Scher is co-founder, chairperson, and CEO of Credo Mobile Working Assets. The company's mission is building a world that is more just, humane, and environmentally sustainable. Ms. Scher believes that everyday activities like talking on the phone can lead to acts of generosity. She co-founded Working Assets in 1985. The company supports positive social change by donating a percentage of its revenue to progressive nonprofit groups working for peace, human rights, equality, education, and the environment. As CEO, she has helped Working Assets grow to more than $100 million in annual revenue. To date, the company and its members have donated more than $60 million to nonprofit groups that members help select. These include Doctors Without Borders, Human Rights Watch, the Global Fund for Women, and Planned Parenthood. Laura Scher is a lecturer at Stanford University teaching social innovation and entrepreneurship at the undergraduate level. Over the past 5 years, she and her colleagues have created a course series and a minor for the next generation of social entrepreneurs. Laura Scher earned her BA in economics from Yale and studied international economics at the Institute for International Studies in Geneva and earned her MBA in 1985 from Harvard Business School. She serves on the board of advisors of the Yale School of Management. So please welcome all of our distinguished panelists. I'm going to start out with a question for any of the panelists that wish to take it up, or all of them, if you choose to answer it. If you could describe the core philosophy that leads you to donate and fundraise, how would you characterize it? What is the motivation for what you do?
Do you want to take
anyone or Ms. Wilsey?
My philosophy about fundraising is completely different from my philosophy about donating, because the things I fundraise for are usually buildings, because I like buildings very much.
Yes.
And what I give to are usually little things like the opening of the opera in the park, things like that. I like those big things too. But my giving is personal. I mean, I like right now education, little before school, I mean, after school programs. I think we really have to support all these things that have been affected so badly by our economy. But I would never really want to fundraise, you know, the way I do for these things. I'd much rather write a check. But in terms of doing capital campaigns and things, I really like big, like the 1.2, I think it's now 3.7 billion dollars. We keep knocking it down. That's why I'm unclear on the number. This afternoon it changed for UC Hospital that I'm doing, or the De Young, or it's only 600 million from the private sector. I don't want to make it sound worse than it is. But the De Young, Grace Cathedral, things like that. I like those great big projects because when they're finished, you can drive by them and say, phew, that's finished. But as far as fundraising, I mean, that's fundraising, but as far as giving, I think anything that really touches you personally, that's my feeling. But I'm only a human. I don't have a corporation. I don't have a foundation. I don't have a husband. I have a dog. I talk to about it, and that's it.
Thank you. Mr. Hellman.
Yeah, well, whoop. Check, check. Well, Dee Dee and I were involved. She said she likes things you can look at. But we work closely together on a thing that you can't see, which is the underground parking facility in Golden Gate Park. Perhaps the most controversial. And
we saw all the protesters.
We sure did. And we also solved them.
Yes, we did.
But if you work with Dee Dee, she's the staunchest, most valuable ally you could probably have in a campaign. And we fought all the fights together. I guess one thing there's something in the back of my mind. I didn't realize I was a philanthropist because I thought a philanthropist was a cross between a philanderer and a misanthrope, but it turns out that isn't always the case. But I guess one thing that I believe most strongly, and I know that the others do too, but having worked with Dee Dee Wilsey, I don't think you can separate philanthropy from politics, from city involvement. And if you think you can, you better think again, because there's nothing that you can do, particularly in this city, that doesn't involve you in politics. I mean, the accursed, now beloved, by the way, the Bicycle Coalition the other day said you build it 400 places too small after fighting us for, 12 years and $5 million illegal fees. But you have to be, there is nothing that's done in this city, and probably not any place, that doesn't have opponents and doesn't involve controversy. I think the garage came before the Board of Supervisors 11 times during its building period, and at one point for a month we had an injunction preventing us from starting. So, I don't believe you can take philanthropy out of the public eye, and I don't think you can take it outside of controversy. And I think Ms. Wilsey and I have one thing in common. We both like controversy. So
we do.
Neither of us
it's
have
fun.
Ever ducked that.
Yeah. Well, we had 56 public hearings on the design of the Tower of the De Young, which had not $1 of public money in it. And we had to have all those hearings, and we had to feed those people when they came to protest and then vote against us. So that was really irritating.
So, Mr. Hellman, it sounds like part of your answer to what motivates you is fighting the good fight.
Well, yeah, and you have to. Well, I guess sometimes you have to know when to hold them and know when to fold them. But it's, being convinced that whatever it is, is a valuable, will become a valuable asset or a valuable, will become valuable in the community. And, you know, if you're fortunate, and I know the others have been, people will look back and say, well, glad you didn't give up. And you're tempted at times to bag it, but in the end, you're glad you did it, I think.
We always believed we were right.
Yeah, well, we were.
Ms. Yamazaki, how do you answer that question? What's your core motivation?
Sure. I'm not much of a controversial person. I don't like controversy that much. I leave that to my husband, who loves controversy.
Yes.
So I can play good cop. My guiding principle would be that I need to be passionate about what I do. And especially now that I'm a mother, I also think about how is this helping the world that my children will be living in. So that became another guiding principle once I became a mother recently.
And sure.
Yes, thank you. Well, thank you, Gloria, for putting together this panel. And it's really an honor to be serving with the three of you because I have a slightly different perspective. So what my philosophy is that business can be the source for social change. It can be the leader in philanthropy. So every year I applaud the San Francisco Business Times and Mary Hughes, who 5 or 6 years ago decided that she would highlight the most philanthropic companies in San Francisco, and that's part of what we're celebrating today. And we have very generous companies, but I did a little research on the numbers that they had in this year's San Francisco Business Times. And there are 6 of the largest 7 companies in the Bay Area are listed, and they donate a lot of money. They donated $75 million to the Bay Area. But what we do at Credo is we donate 1% of our revenue. And if these companies were to donate a percentage of their revenue, this would be
great.
A lot of money. So this was an astounding statistic for me. The revenue of these 7 companies ranges from $40 billion to $273 billion. So if the 6 of these companies donated 1% of their revenue, they would be donating $7 billion. And you could build a lot of buildings. And Stanford could give a lot of scholarships. So everyone here could solve a lot of the problems that we're facing if companies would embrace this philosophy that Credo has and has been doing for so many years.
A very interesting thought. What do you see as priorities for philanthropic dollars in this recession? Do you think that the priorities have changed? Have your priorities changed given the economic downturn? Or should it be stay the course on what you're doing or respond to the greater human needs? How do you see the recession affecting your philanthropy?
Well, I guess, in a sense, one, the needs are clearly greater. I mean, you think of an organization like Jewish Vocational Services, whose, you know, clientele has gone up by 30%. And I guess the simple way to look at it is you first have to stay the course. And you can't decide that what you gave to X or Y, you're only going to give 50%, unless you really never liked them anyway, which there are examples of that. But by and large, the first priority is to stay the course and perhaps increase to the ones that you think are most have a much greater demand. My daughter's free clinic, their demand is up by almost 50%. So, you know, this sounds very cocky, but you're not giving away a huge percentage of your net worth, and to keep it constant, I know this sounds arrogant, but to keep it constant is really important, constant or increase it. The needs are greater. And it isn't going to decimate your net worth if you do that. So that sounds very preachy, but that's sort of my nature.
Other thoughts about changes in priorities for yourself or philanthropy in general during the recession?
I think your instinct is not being a great entrepreneur like Warren. I think, personally, because all of us, we just get letters after letters after letters every day asking for money. And I have to say, the ones where I never really liked them too much anyway, it's a great opportunity to say, I'll give you a little less. But the ones who really are needy, and there are so many, it's a great opportunity to say, I'm really going to help you because you need it. And then there's that moment where I say to myself, I wonder if I have any money left. And then you just say, well, so what? You know, they need it, and I've got enough clothes, and I shouldn't need any more anyway. And, you know, the only thing you have to worry about are all the pledges you have outstanding. And I do sometimes wonder how I'm going to pay UC that huge amount. And I have given in perpetuity the opening weekend to the opera. I hope I don't live that long. You know, I'm not sure what perpetuity is really going to mean, but anyway, and some of the other things that I do, but I really enjoy them. But I think that it's a very good feeling to think you actually can make a difference, either in a person's life, a school's life, a group's life, whatever, if you really have an opportunity to change something. That, I think, gives you enormous pleasure. To know whether it's costumes for a play or instruments for a band or reading programs after school or whatever it is, to think that you actually can make a difference is, to me, the really motivating factor.
Well, we've seen our customers become much more active in our philanthropy. So we're lucky in that our donations are generated by people using their phone service. So I bet everybody here has a cell phone. So, and you probably haven't given up your cell phone. So we're still generating donations, but our customers are much more active in voting on how the money should be allocated. One of the unique parts of how our donations are selected is that the customers nominate the groups, and then they are presented with a ballot, and they vote on how to allocate the money among those groups. And this year we've seen a much higher percentage of our customers participating because they're still generating donations just by talking on the phone every day. But what we see in our nonprofits is that what they've been trying to do is engage their donors in volunteer activities so that they don't lose touch with their donors, and the hope is that when they are able to donate again, they can be reactivated as donors, but at least they stay true to the mission and involved with the nonprofit group.
I agree completely with Warren. To stay the course as a donor, I mean, this is a time of great need, and as an individual donor, that's the least that you can do. But as a board member or a person that is involved in a nonprofit, I think this is also a time where you can help an organization have a very clear vision and be very disciplined about the work that they do. And it can be sometimes an opportunity to rethink the operations or how an organization may be carrying out its work. At the Asian Art Museum, for example, here's the curator and the executive director here supporting me tonight. Thank you. We just finished a 5-year strategic plan, and it was the first time in the organization that we've actually looked beyond the year-to-year budgets and have actually planned out the next 5 years. And we made a call to the board members to support financially some of the initiatives that we are undertaking for the next 5 years. And before we even made the announcement, half of the money was already raised. Of course, that's thanks to the great fundraising ability of our new director. But it was really a great show of support from our most loyal constituents.
So I'd like to follow up on Ms. Scher's comment about the companies and potential for giving a percent of their revenue. Do you make any efforts to proselytize, to expand the pie by lobbying companies to do that? Does anyone do that?
Well, we hoped to, but I think the best proselytizer is someone who Warren and I know, who is Mark Benioff, who leads Salesforce.com. And they started their company before it even went public, by donating a percentage of the equity into a foundation, and have just as core to their DNA is volunteerism and social responsibility. And I think that he's done a very good job of getting other companies in the Bay Area to join them. We've been doing what we've been doing for a long time, and we hope to influence other people, and we have over the years. But it's great to see someone who has a publicly held company able to have this mission of giving back and having it be core to what they're doing.
So I'd like to ask each of you, putting on your hats as fundraisers, not just donors, what was the greatest success? What do you consider your greatest success as a fundraiser in each of your cases where you've gone to raise money for something that you, either you were or weren't a major donor, but where you were raising money for other people to donate. Warren?
Well, I think the greatest success was perhaps the smallest campaign, and you asked, and that was the, quote, garage. And we had really fantastic meetings where, I don't think Chuck is here, but I went to see Chuck Schwab and made the pitch. Halfway through, he said, wait a minute, you're asking me for money for a garage. Are you crazy? So, and he put up a considerable amount of money. But, you know, that was certainly the greatest challenge and the hardest money, not the largest campaign, but the hardest money I've ever been involved in.
And what did you tell him, by the way, to get him to say yes?
Basically, and Dee Dee and I share the story, but there was a move to, which she knows far better than I do, but there was a move to move the two major institutions, the De Young and the Academy, out of the park. And I thought that was horrendous. I personally thought it was horrendous. But in order to stay in the park, they had to do something about parking. An underground garage. So and Dee Dee was a huge help in this. We made a bunch of pitches together, and with Dee Dee, you never strike out. So we got far more money from some of the donors than I would have on my own. But basically, it was a difficult thing to understand. You couldn't have, you know, beautiful renderings of a garage.
It looked better than the De Young.
At that point.
At that point.
So that was a real challenge to make the case, which, you know, when we were successful, people got it and gave, you know, quite generously.
So other examples of difficult asks or successes that you're proud of in fundraising?
My most difficult was not the De Young, and Warren and I had really fun on that garage, I have to say. You know, it's great when you can look back on an awful situation and say, that was really fun.
Yeah,
we really
right.
enjoyed that. And I did enjoy that very much. But my most difficult one was, before I did the De Young, I did Grace Cathedral. And people don't remember. The real sign of success is when nobody remembers you've done something. But there was a building in front of Grace Cathedral, seismically damaged, that was the Diocesan House, and it covered the Ghiberti doors. And you couldn't see the steps. The steps were a wreck anyway. And so the bishop, Bishop Swing, came to me and he said, would you please do this campaign? And at the time, I was absolutely clueless about how you raise money anyway. And I didn't want to tear down the building. I actually liked the building very much. So I was not in favor of the campaign. But I forgot to call him back and tell him that I didn't want to do it. So time went by, and then one day he called me and he said, I'm so happy you're doing the campaign. And I'm terrified. I said, I really don't think I can do that campaign, Bishop. And he said, of course you can. And I said, well, you know, it's a lot of money. It was like $6 million. It turned into 17. But, and this is when money was more money. And so I said, well, you know, Bishop, I really haven't got an idea. He said, oh, don't be silly. Of course you can do it. And so I thought, God, I should have called him back if I just had returned the phone call. But it had been a month. So I'm much better at phone calls now. So anyway, I really learned my lesson. Time went on, and I finally said, look, I have no idea how to raise that money. Nobody wants to do this. Nobody wants to give money to a cathedral. And he said, Dee Dee, the Lord will provide. And I said, that is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. And I repeated this, I mean, publicly. This is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. That's fine for a bishop, but what am I going to do? So I'd go out and I'd ask people for money, thinking, oh, gosh, you know, this is so dumb. And they'd give me money. And I thought, wow, that's amazing. And so I'd ask another one. I got money. And finally, I thought, God, that bishop really knows something that I didn't know. And so he'd get up and make these speeches, and he'd say, Dee Dee has been, I can't remember the word, like inspired or blessed or something. And I'd look at him, oh, yeah, okay. But I got more money. And the next thing you know, I had all the money. And we had a ceremony at Grace Cathedral, incense burning, all kinds of things going on. And he said, you know, really want to thank Dee Dee for getting all this money. I told her the Lord would provide. And I thought, I'm not saying a word because this lightning could strike in here, thunder, all kinds of things. Yeah. But we got the money. And I had told the DeYoung I would do their campaign. So I said, let's set a date. Let's make it Easter. And my husband was alive at the time. He was a very staunch Catholic, had nothing to do with Grace Cathedral, wouldn't give him a dime. And so I'm sitting next to this Catholic on Easter Sunday saying to myself, if you just will let me out of this cathedral without lightning, without the roof collapsing, I got you the money, and I really do believe that the Lord provided. And I'm going to go forth and make speeches about the Lord providing money because it certainly happened to me. And I think it was remarkable. I still don't know how we got all that money. And the building looks great. So that was my toughest by far.
Okay, that's a good story. What other stories of...
When we started, our first donations at Credo were $32,000 a year. And when we started our phone service, at that year, AT&T decided to stop funding Planned Parenthood. And they were funding Planned Parenthood at the time $50,000 a year. And we thought, wouldn't it be incredible if this tiny little phone company in San Francisco could replace that $50,000? That was our sort of dream in 1988. And in 1992, we raised $1 million, and our customers voted to give $55,000 to Planned Parenthood. So we gave this check, and we started replacing AT&T. And I don't know if this is a good story or a sad story, but we are, this little phone company in California, the largest donor to Planned Parenthood, the largest corporate donor to Planned Parenthood. And we've donated more than $1 million, thanks to our customers, since 1992. Yeah.
My story will be about my greatest succumb rather than than fundraising. It was back in 1997 or 1998 when the then president of Stanford University asked Jerry and I to come to Hoover House, which is where the president of Stanford lives. And, you know, we had some idea what he was going to ask us, but it was back when we had no idea even how much we were really worth and how much money we even had in cash, and Jerry and I kind of strategized about not really getting sucked into this. And as we had a fluffy lunch of, fennel salad or something like that, Gerhard just came for the kill, and we were just wrapped around in his little finger, and there we were roped into being the co-chairs for the undergraduate campaign, which... we were very honored to be part of, in great company with Chuck and Helen Schwab and Helen and Peter Bing, the Basses.
And so what was your most challenging ask for that campaign?
And well, when you have someone like Gerhard, you just let him talk and nothing is challenging. So my strategy was to just stand next to him and zip kind it of, and he'll do all the talking.
Kind of the equivalent of Bishop Swing. You
know. I thought of another one today. When we first moved back here, Chris became involved with the San Francisco Ballet and became president. And the ballet, the timing was perfect. Just at the time that Helgi Thomason came to run the ballet, the Chronicle hired a reviewer by the name of Octavio Roca, who in Washington had written an article for not the Washington Post, the Washington Star, saying, why did they bring these terrible regional ballets to Washington? And they moved him out here to be the critic. And he did nothing that there was nothing he couldn't do to undermine the ballet. And we were starting out with a $27 million campaign. And the first call I made was on one of the local foundations who said, well, why should I support this? Look at this review of Romeo and Juliet. And the article started with possibly the worst Romeo and Juliet ever staged anywhere. So the way I won't get too long-winded on this, and I know that I'm taking up other people's time, but we thought, what the hell are we going to do about this with a capital campaign? So this young woman named Laurie Smith and I started a website called Voice of Dance, and the early purpose of it has changed a lot, was to critique the critics. So every time he would come out with a terrible review, we would print all the other reviews of the same, like Anna Kiselgoff in the New York Times said, one of the best Romeo and Juliet's right. ever staged. So we would take with us on all our calls, okay, here's what this guy says, But let me tell you what the world says. And that raised us a lot of money.
Great
that
idea.
Was fun.
Great idea. So someone
in the audience would like to know if any of you have any advice for organizations who have been affected by the economy. Is there a most effective way for them to fundraise these days?
Ask.
Yes.
People are afraid to ask.
Yeah.
It's true of trustees. I run into it all the time. People constantly say to me, how do you raise money? And it's so simple. You ask.
Well, it's definitely not going to happen if you don't.
But people are really afraid. And particularly in this economy, because I think the majority of organizations have cut down, organizations who are donors, which are donors, so you expect to be turned down. And as it was said earlier tonight, people who give money or are fundraisers are passionate about their causes. But people who ask for money are passionate about their cause. And I think that is the most compelling thing for anybody. If you, as a donor, if someone comes to you and they're passionate about their cause, how do you say no? You can't. And I think that my greatest piece of advice to anybody on either side is truly believe in what you're doing. Don't do it if you don't. Go find something else to do. But if you really believe in it, it's contagious. But don't think of a turndown as something personal. And I used to say this with the DeYoung raising money. You know, I didn't ask them to pay my Saks bill. I asked them to build the building. So if they turn me down, I don't think of it as a personal insult. I said, do you like the building? Actually, I never asked anybody if they liked the building because it was really a hideous building, and I didn't want to get into that discussion. But the point is, you know, it needed to be built because we needed a home for art. Whatever this organization is, it's there because it has a need. And that's what you need to express to whoever you're going to talk to. But don't be afraid to ask, and don't expect a turndown.
Good advice. I think also Akiko brought up an important point earlier, being clear about your strategy. I find donors asking me now, how have you adjusted to the recession? What are you doing to tighten up your operations? You know, how are you making yourself as effective as possible? But that's another thought about how to fundraise is to have a good story to tell in terms of how you're dealing with the downturn. Any other thoughts on that question? So another questioner in the audience brings up the following point. Former President Bill Clinton recently suggested that fundraising in the future will look more like President Obama's fundraising campaign, small but more gifts. Do you have an opinion about his comment? And let me just add something. I'm on the board at my undergraduate college, which has just hired Blue States Digital to work in its fundraising, and that was the company that was an architect of President Obama's. They're trying to move over now into the traditional fundraising development for nonprofits. So any comment on that? Will fundraising look more like the internet Obama campaign, small donations?
Well, I'll try to answer that. I think the power of the Obama campaign was not just asking for small contributions, but getting people involved. And sort of people went door to door, people made phone calls, people really got involved in addition to making small contributions. So he actually used tactics from the 60s and 70s, sort of grassroots activism. And I think that that is something that we've certainly been doing a lot of. It's really sort of the tradition that Working Essence Credo was founded out of. So we set as one of our goals this year is to pass comprehensive health care reform. And in August, when it looked like the public option was dead, when the recess started, we, among other organizations, galvanized on the web. We generated over 890,000 impressions, signatures, letters, faxes, emails, phone calls, all to put the public option back in. One of our most successful campaigns was tell President Obama the public option is not optional. And the history is being written, but it's no longer dead on arrival. And so we see the activism on the web being a combination of making it easy for people to make a difference, but also making it easy to make them part of the process. The other thing we did in this campaign is that we held 12 district meetings in key representatives, and we had over 100 of our members attend those meetings, all facilitated through the internet, but nonetheless using both the sort of old grassroots activism combined with this new technology.
I completely agree with you. I think what the technology is enabling here is really being the aggregator. So even if you're making a $25 contribution, by the time you have 2 million people, 5 million people doing this, it becomes a very impactful thing. You may all be familiar with Kiva, which is a tool, if you will, that allows you to make a direct connection between the donor and the, what they call the social entrepreneur that you would like to fund. And if you check on their website, they claim that this week they've made $1 million in investment. And since their inception, it's been over $100 million that they've been able to create these loans from $25 increments to all over the world. So when you think about how the web and these technology enablers are now playing a very big role in what I would call the democratization and globalization of giving, it is quite outstanding. But having said that, I don't think that it's one way or another. I think that there will be a role for fundraising in the traditional way, in these kind of new ways. And the great thing is that it is allowing everybody to participate.
Mr. Hellman?
Well, off the question, I think in our business, and I think generally throughout business, there's really been a sea change in giving. I mean, I started on Wall Street, and the idea was, someday you might make some money, and someday you might give away some money. I haven't had a single young employee of our firm in the past five or six years, who hasn't come in and said, gee, I really like education, I really like environment. And I think I'm really, really hopeful that the younger generation, the people in their, let's say, 25 to 40, are going to have a whole different attitude than the people who are now, well, let's say from 60 to my age. And there isn't going to be a huge gap between the time they start to earn their money and the time they start to give away. And also... In terms of their volunteering, so I'm up. That's kind of a corollary of the same thing. People start to give and start to give time far younger than they used to.
That's an exciting possibility. Do others see that happening as well?
Oh my! The class that I teach that I'm part of at Stanford is, I think, a perfect example. It was driven by the students. They wanted to be taught about social entrepreneurship, and they brought in business people like myself to help teach it, and they made it into a minor. So every year there are well over 100 Stanford students participating in some way in a course series on social entrepreneurship who want that to be the core of how they go into the world after they graduate.
I have not found that to be the case. I think it's true with the younger ones. I agree with everything you just said. But there is a group who are young, maybe a little older than that, the dot-comers, they don't give money. They don't understand they're rich. They don't know how much money they have. And it's not in the bank. It's not in the vault. It didn't come from a grandfather or a father. And they are the most insecure group of philanthropists I've ever seen in my life. I've tried with the UC Hospital Project. They have wasted more time of more people trudging around Mission Bay and then saying, maybe I'll give you $1 million when they're worth $1 billion. What a waste of time. So
okay.
I have not been impressed.
So let's talk about Silicon Valley and the tech industry. Akiko.
Didi, have you come south of Sand Hill?
Well, we do, yeah. So I think
Mission
that's
Bay.
The deal. And we have some people on our committee who are... what do you call those? Rich people. Rich.com people. I don't want to mention any names. Very well known. And they're supposed to be making forays into that world. But I said, while you're making the foray, explain to them they're rich and they can give away money and it'll feel really good. So I know that there are established people like yourself, and there are who I would call the royalty of that world. But it's frustrating when there are other people where you pick up the paper, you read about them, you go to the meeting, and you say, oh, no, 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 I couldn't do that. And I think, yes, you could. You'd so love it. So it's an education thing. I think in maybe another, I don't know how long it takes a person to feel comfortable, but I think that's our job, to try to make them feel, you can do this. You are really smart. And guess what? If you lose it, you can make it again. You already did that.
Sure. Okay, so there are many dimensions of this. There's the issue of San Francisco institutions fundraising from Silicon Valley. But then again, San Jose institutions have trouble in this area, too, in terms of the arts organizations. There's the issue of whether people involved in the tech industry give or don't give or are giving more or less than they ever have. I mean, any other thoughts about this? Is anything changing in Silicon Valley? Is it simply a mismatch of their interests? I mean, sure, you know, Ikiko and her husband have been incredibly generous,
right,
to organizations all over the Bay Area and elsewhere. Meg Whitman, for instance, has given to her alma mater extremely generously. Some folks have given, you know, who went to Caltech have given to Caltech. So, I mean, is it matching?
The Stanford people just have the whole neighborhood sewed up.
Yes.
It's unbelievable.
So is it just a question of matching the people to their interests, or what's going on here?
Can I take a stab at that?
Yes.
Since I do represent that group. There definitely was a perception of, I think there was even a term called cyber stinginess. Mm-hmm. And I used to get that a lot when I served at the ballet board.
Oh, yeah.
How do we crack your group? How do we get down there? Why don't people give to our cause? And why don't they like coming to the ballet? Well, back about 10 years ago when the dot-com boom was actually happening, first of all, people were working really hard. And there was no time to come to the ballet. And you need to understand that philanthropy is not something that comes naturally. I think this is, as anything, requires a learning curve. You have to decide for yourself what is your passion, what you want to make your life work. And there was a learning curve that we were just discussing this as I was driving up with my friends up in the car today. That probably took a good 5 to 10 years. And there were people like Laura Arriaga, who you probably know, and a colleague of yours, that took this and made it into an academic approach. Why aren't people in Silicon Valley giving, even though there has been this incredible generation of wealth? And she basically said, well, people are not used to giving. Secondly, they're really not feeling connected to the organizations that they're being asked by. Because a lot of them actually did not come from Silicon Valley. They are, you know, as you know, Silicon Valley is a melting pot, a true attractive place for people to come and work. So there are people from all over the country and the world who have come there. So they weren't necessarily connected through through generations. To these causes or organizations. And I think, as I said, it took a little while for us as a group to learn how to do philanthropy. And now that 10 years or so have passed, I greatly defer, Didi, with your assessment of the situation, because I think that we as a group have grown tremendously and have become very wise. I think a lot of innovative ideas in this area have come because of the new wave of philanthropists and groups. Laura's SV2 being one. I want to give a plug to my organization, WCN, which is a organization that I co-founded with my friend Charlie, who's sitting right there, that actually really speaks to the core of how I think people in the Valley like to give, and that is to have a very strong connection to what you're giving to. So basically this idea of my money is going to that person, my money is going to this project, is something that really appeals to the Silicon Valley crowd. And I think that if you drove down and actually crossed Sand Hill and came south of Sand Hill, you will see that there's very, very generous people.
And there may be also a condition of age as well. Mm-hmm. As I think more, Chuck Geschke is very generous and so on. Those who have come out, the other side of founding their companies and running them often become generous donors. Mm-hmm. We've talked a little bit about social entrepreneurship, and I know we have an expert down at the end of the row here. Do you see the concept of social entrepreneurship being effectively pursued by many nonprofits? Is it making a difference for them and the constituents they serve? Social entrepreneurship, is it being widely practiced, do you think, and is it making a difference?
I actually like to think about it from the other side, which is businesses which become socially entrepreneurial. And I think Salesforce is a perfect example of that. And I think we're seeing more corporations adopt models of giving back and being more responsible and not just being sort of out just for the shareholder, but out to develop their communities, their employees, the stakeholders, to become corporate donors to projects in the communities that they work in. So I look at that as a trend that really has been going on, sort of for 15 years or more, but is becoming more it's becoming more popular as the web makes it easier to understand more about the businesses that you buy from, so that you can really do research and see whether these businesses are really practicing what they're preaching and doing the things that they claim to be doing. I think it's harder for nonprofits to do this, and I think it takes a slightly slightly different approach to what they're doing, and I caution the groups that I work with not to be distracted from your core mission just in search of how to raise more money. It might be more effective to get someone to give $1 million to your project than it is to start selling something or building a program where you raise a couple pennies every time someone does something. So I like to encourage businesses to be more socially entrepreneurial.
Do you see any nonprofit activities in the Bay Area that you think are particularly innovative? And is there a new wave of innovation coming, perhaps partly stimulated by the recession? I mean, we have Kiva.org. We've had quite a bit of creativity in the nonprofit sector. What do you see that excites you that's particularly entrepreneurial about addressing a social problem?
Of course. Talk about a favorite project?
Of course.
There are probably those of you in the room who've noticed that the coverage of local news has fairly much collapsed in print over the last 5 years. I think there are something like 45% fewer reporters in the Bay Area than there were. And I think the fallout from that, I won't belabor the point, is just tremendous. So that, the area of news dissemination, I think nationally, not just here, there's sort of a wave of not-for-profits starting in the news delivery area, and the one we're starting to be, the news project. I wanted to call it hardly strictly news, but the name was taken. I think that's happening. I know it's happened in Minneapolis. It's happened in San Diego. And the idea of a news hub rather than simply a newspaper, that is, a hub that feeds internet, print, television, radio, et cetera, is going to be something that we're going to become very familiar with over the next 5 hours or 5 years or something.
Would you describe a little bit your Bay Area News Project?
Ad nauseum or just...
No, minus nauseum, but adequately.
Well, basically the idea was that we would form a news center, and we will have probably 12 to 15 reporters that all of you have heard of covering sectors. And essentially, it will disseminate news through, think of it as a hub and spoke operation. We will have a major internet presence. We're partnering with KQED, and KQED Public Radio will provide a daily local news broadcast as well as weekly television broadcast on local on local news. Hopefully, the New York Times, which is now starting to print locally, will use us as an insert twice a week that'll cover only local news. We've partnered with the UC School of Journalism, and they will be providing students as sort of foot soldiers. So these reporters will use the students either to come up with news stories or to follow stories in which they're interested, so you can operate with a far smaller repertorial staff than the existing sources have. So that's essentially what we do, and I'll have a booth right by the street where you can all donate.
Sounds good. Now, my
question. It will be a 501c3.
My question is about sustainability. So you've generously given $5 million to set this off with a bang, so to speak. What happens once that $5 million is gone?
Hopefully, there will be a variety of sources. One, like public broadcast, we will have membership drives. We'll probably have whole issues that are devoted only to try and extract money, like they do on TV and radio. But we will have membership drives. We've already had a first pretty good grant from a national foundation who says, this is the first year we're going to do this for this project. We think that there is government money, federal money for retraining of news people involved in news. We hope that wealthy individuals will be supportive, and we can take a certain amount of advertising and not be. I mean, like, National Geographic has a lot of advertising, so we think that we can get up to 30% of our revenues from, and possibly more from, traditional advertising sources. And when I stop smoking controlled substances, this will all come true.
Well, it's a lot closer to coming true than it was not long ago.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Well, we'll see.
A couple of you mentioned that the recession is a good opportunity to throw overboard causes or organizations that you weren't that excited about. What makes you, someone in the audience wants to know, what makes you stop giving to a nonprofit?
I wouldn't say you'd stop giving. You just don't give them quite as much.
But what makes you stop giving, if you ever do that?
They disband.
That's it?
No. Well, I think if they do something that you just really don't believe in, this morning I was doing that kind of mail. It's the first time I asked for a real breakdown. This is a very good organization and one I've supported for years, but they were very cavalier about their financials, mm-hmm. and normally I wouldn't care, but this time I know a couple people on the board and I was not impressed with, they have a little pie, and then they send me the pie, but they send it in black and white. A pie in black and white is meaningless.
You need to see
the colors, right? So I thought, well, obviously they don't care what I think about their financials. So I wrote back and I said, I'd like to know what corporations you are funded by and what foundations and what is the average gift of your board members, it's not very big, but I mean, it was just the sort of principle of the thing. Mm-hmm. Because I think what's happened is I've given to them for so long, it's sort of like they think, oh, well, that's automatic, don't bother about her. And I think that's the kind of thing that makes you think, well, wait a minute, there's so many good organizations. And there also are wonderful ones like Tipping Point, which is new, Daniel Lurie, wonderful person. New organizations come along every day that are doing, just magnificent things in this community. And it isn't that you don't want to continue to support others, but they're just great new things, and you want to do things for them as well.
Gloria, I have to be rude. I have to be someplace 20 minutes ago. So.
Okay.
You'll have to. The level of dialogue will go up a lot, but I have to excuse myself.
Okay. Thank you, Warren.
Bye, Warren.
Thank you. We have just 5 minutes more, so we'll miss you, but thank you. Thank you. Okay. Other comments about what causes you to stop giving to nonprofits? a certain nonprofit?
In our case, I don't think that we've stopped giving to a nonprofit that we have been supporting. There have been some cases where we promised a three-year grant or so on, and then there's a natural stopping point. But again, I think it goes back to, you know, for us, an organization, as Dee Dee said, has to demonstrate to us that they are fiscally responsible, that they are being as efficient as possible as they can be.
In our donations pool, we do give to different groups every year, and we tend not to fund the same group twice in a row, so we actually don't give to a group twice in a row. But a reason that a group may no longer be on our donations ballot may be that they have lost their vision, or their vision has been accomplished and they haven't moved on to another one. Also, a change of leadership where there isn't a strong leader with the same vision who takes the place of the leadership would also be a reason why we would no longer be funding an organization.
There's been a bit of a controversy stimulated partly by Dick Goldman over whether organizations should accumulate endowments and whether philanthropists should contribute to endowments versus insist that organizations spend funds on operating expenses. I think at least two of you have participated in establishing endowments for organizations. Do I assume then that you believe that endowments are important for organizations? How do you fall in that controversy about whether endowments are important or money should be spent out and new money raised down the road from other donors?
I think you have to have an endowment. I mean, endowment is just, in my opinion, and this is just my opinion, fiscally responsible. However, my husband, for instance, who was very generous, wouldn't give to endowment because he said, how do you know what the leadership of that organization will be in X number of years? Maybe I won't agree with it, so I don't want to give to their endowment. And I know other people who feel that way, so we come up with clever words like bridge funds and so forth and say, would you give to that? And I think my husband had a point, but I think that's why you choose your organization. If it's the opera, I happen to be a big donor to the opera, it's opera. It's going to be opera in 20 years, probably, or 50 years. Same with the ballet. I've been on the ballet board since 1973. They're still dancing. I mean, they've had a change, but there's still Swan Lake and things I like. They also dance things I don't like at all, but that's what makes it interesting. Our museums, you know, I'm so prejudiced I won't even speak of that, but I do believe endowment is very important, and I do believe in a draw. I don't believe in a high draw, but I think 5%, and particularly in this day and age, is fiscally responsible. And I think sometimes organizations get a little piggy about their endowment, and they do drives that really are excessive, but they generally don't achieve them anyway. Mm-hmm. And I don't believe in doing a drive where you lump capital campaigns, endowments, whatever else you want to throw in there. I think a campaign should be clear about what you are being asked to donate to. And if it's endowment, it's endowment, whatever. Because then you know, you can say no to this one and I'll give to that one. But I think it's really today, it's like a savings account for an individual.
I think it's dependent a little bit on the nature of the organization that you're supporting. A university, an arts organization, I believe that it should have an endowment because it's not just for our generation, but it's also for the next generation. But if you're dealing with an endangered species like we do in the Wildlife Organization Conservation Network, there's no time to be building up an endowment. We have to send as much money as we can to the field. So it depends on the nature of the organization.
Laura?
Well, I just think an endowment, I mean, I don't think there's a right or wrong answer. It depends on the organization. It depends on the donor, whether they want to support an endowment. But endowment in a difficult economic time acts as a buffer. And so the organizations that have endowments are going to be able to weather an economic downturn much better. And so from that perspective, I think it's good for many organizations to have an endowment.
Unfortunately, it's time for the last question. We've almost come to the end of our program. And I'd like to ask each of you, what advice do you have for those without great wealth who still wish to be philanthropic?
I don't think it makes any difference how wealthy that you are. I mean, you give to something because you care about it, you believe in it, you believe in the people who run that organization, any one of those things, because you want to help them, because you want to make it better. I know at the museum and other organizations in which I'm involved, I'm so impressed by the fact that the donors who are the most valuable are not the big donors. It's the constant annual donor. And in this recession, we see that they have not left us. And I was talking to somebody in another organization today about that. The small donor is the valuable donor. I was at Salvation Army earlier today. We were talking about that. These pennies, I mean, they really do mount up. And I don't think anyone should feel that they are less significant than the largest possible donor, because they're doing their part, and that's the important thing. If everybody will do something, we'll all be better off.
Terrific. Akiko? Yes, I think we can all support that idea.
I agree with Dee Dee completely. I think that the real currency is the power to inspire. It's not so much the dollar amount, but as a volunteer or as somebody who gives $25 and shows your passion, you can make a huge difference in an organization. The Wildlife Conservation Network couldn't exist without the volunteers that we have. There are 60 people that, if you were to monetize that, I don't even know what that would amount to. But without it, we couldn't operate. And so there's many, many ways in which people can participate.
So you don't leave me very much to add to that. But I'd like to talk about the Global Fund for Women, because it's an organization that's based here in San Francisco, but it donates money around the world. And not only does it donate money, which we in the United States donate to them, but in every country that they're active, the women who live in those communities also donate so that other women in their communities can receive funds. So we're talking about potentially pennies a day, yet the inspiration, the participation, the sense of community that these small donors are giving to these organizations all over the world is as powerful as each of us making a donation of whatever amount we can afford to a group that we care about.
Thank you. Well, I'd like to say thank you to our distinguished panel of philanthropists, Diane Dee Dee Wilsey, President of the Board of Trustees of the Fine Arts Museum of San Francisco, Akiko Yamazaki, donor and co-chair, along with husband and Yahoo founder Jerry Yang, to Stanford University's $1 billion campaign for undergraduate education, Laura Schur, co-founder, chairperson, and CEO of Credo Mobile Working Assets, and in absentia, Warren Hellman, trustee emeritus of the San Francisco Foundation, and founder, among many other things, of the Hardly Strictly Bluegrass Festival. We also thank you, our audience here at the PG&E Auditorium in San Francisco, and our audiences on the radio, television, and internet. The program tonight, as you recall, is in association with the Golden Gate Chapter of the Association of Fundraising Professionals and the Northern California Grantmakers in celebration of National Philanthropy Day. To learn more about National Philanthropy Day, you can visit www.afp-gfc.org/NPD. That's a mouthful. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the Commonwealth Club, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place to be in the know, is adjourned. Now, immediately following this program tonight, we thank you all for coming. There's going to be a presentation of awards by the co-chairs of National Philanthropy Day 2009, Marilyn Bansal and Pamela Cook. So they're going to come up on stage. We're going to exit. Thank you to you all. And this concludes the Commonwealth Club's part of the program. Thank you.